Hello and welcome. This is Your Call. I'm Renee Kemp, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. Last November, California voters voted yes on Proposition 64. That opened a pathway to legalize the growth, sale, and use of recreational marijuana. And in doing so, California joined a small but growing handful of states that now will be allowing adult recreational use of that drug. That new law is set to go into effect in just a few short days, January 1st, just around the corner. So what can we expect? We can possibly look to other states like Washington and Colorado for some examples of what to do or not do. But certainly California is unique. For example, unlike other states, we already have an established $21 billion cannabis economy, and that economy will somehow have to transition from largely illicit operations into operations that are permitted and sanctioned and monitored. So you can expect to see some snags, no doubt, as these new laws go into effect. And just because recreational use will become legal at the state level, certainly doesn't mean that it'll be available or sanctioned in the area where you live in California. Depending on where you live, it could still be sanctioned. So each municipality is able to decide how to handle these things, things like permits and zoning. And certainly, let's not forget that marijuana, despite the vote in California, is still classified federally as a Schedule I drug. So today, we're going to sort through some of the tangles and talk to a couple of experts about what we can expect. Joining us today is Brooke Staggs. Brooke is a general assignment reporter for the Southern California News Group. She's based at the Orange County Register. Her focus has been on covering the statewide politics, business, health, and culture of cannabis. She's the lead writer for Canifornian. See what we did there? Canifornian. It's a news website that covers cannabis issues in California. They launched just last year, just one day after the passage of Prop 64. And Brooke is joining us by phone from Anaheim, California. Hi, Brooke. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
You bet. And Dale Garinger, he's the state director of California NORML. That acronym stands for the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws. He's also the author of the Marijuana Medical Handbook. Dale is an active member of various drug policy reform boards from the local to the national, and he's actually a commissioner on the City of Oakland's Cannabis Regulatory Commission. He was one of the original authors of California's Medical Marijuana Initiative. That was good old Prop 215 back in 2004. It has certainly come full circle. And he was also a founding member of Project CBD. Dale is joining us by phone from Oakland. Dale Garinger, thank you for being here.
Good to be here. Thank you.
Yes, indeed. So let's invite listeners. This is one of those things that listeners have always asked us to talk about. So what do you want to know about how your city or county may be preparing for legalized recreational marijuana? And how do you think local governments and the state government should be navigating the transition? Give us a call at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. Okay, let's start by setting the stage for the conversation. And I'm going to ask both you, Dale, and you, Brooke, to weigh in on this. If you would take us back to November of 2016, when California voters passed Prop 64, legalizing recreational marijuana. Were either of you surprised? Did you expect it to happen? Dale, I'm going to start with you because certainly your history on this goes at least as far back as 2004. Did you expect it to happen? What did you anticipate being the problems?
Yeah, sure, I expected it to happen. In fact, I predicted the exact percentage outcome of the election the day before. California was, after all, only following in the steps of Colorado and Washington and Alaska and Washington, D.C. So, yes, we knew that the public was ready for this. But it doesn't really seem any different now here a year later than it did on election night. There's been very little change, even though marijuana has actually become legal for general adult use, because the sales have not started yet.
Why do you think that nothing has changed?
Just because the sales haven't started. So people who want to get marijuana commercially basically have to be in the medical cannabis market, and the medical cannabis market is about like it was now, like it was a year ago, but everybody has been frantically gearing up for this regulation system that's coming January 1st.
Exactly. My guess is that because you watch what's happening behind the scenes, it might not have looked like anything was happening, but my guess is that there was a mad scramble behind the scenes by cities and municipalities to get ready for this, yes?
Yeah, pretty much every city and county in the state is obliged to come up with some sort of policy about it, because the state regulations are based on the assumption that the local governments approve or disapprove of cannabis themselves. And so we have seen a mad scramble by local governments.
And Brooke Staggs, what did you anticipate as potential problems in the preparation year? We've had all this year to get ready. Did you anticipate some problems that would come up as we were getting ready to ramp up for this, and have those concerns been justified?
Yeah, there was definitely a lot of concern about whether, you know, California could get this all in place, all the rules in place, and rein everything in within a year. I think there was a lot of skepticism about whether that would happen, but the state, we call her the pot czar, the cannabis chief for the state, has said from day one that she was going to stick to the January 1st start of sales, and we are on track for that. It is still going to be, you know, very much last minute. We're still waiting for them to put out applications so that businesses can start applying for temporary permits. That'll get issued on New Year's Day and in the days to follow that. So, you know, there has been, like you said, just a flurry of activity happening behind the scenes. But it did, you know, as of the day after the election, it became legal for anyone 21 and over in California to possess up to an ounce of cannabis, to grow up to six plants per household, to give it away to another 21-year-old. So all of those personal rights are in effect, but it's, as Dale said, you don't really see those, you know, happening on the surface. So if those are happening behind the scenes, you know, since that date, we haven't really seen, you know, much of that coming out, but it'll be January 1st that we'll really see all the big changes kick in.
Well, you mentioned the election, Brooke, and irony of ironies, at the same time that California legalized recreational pot use for adults 21 and over, the country also elected Donald Trump to the White House, and he subsequently appointed Jeff Sessions to head the Justice Department. And Sessions has certainly been staunchly against any movement toward legalizing cannabis. And there was certainly already an inherent tension between states and the federal government regarding the legality or illegality of marijuana. So to what extent did the political developments of 2016 kind of move California and the White House further apart? Dale Garinger?
Well, I don't know that it has yet. Initially, after the election, a number of local government officials were expressing concern that the new administration would go after marijuana. But things have sort of calmed down. Mr. Sessions has said he sort of respects the ongoing rules that the Justice Department had under Obama, which was basically a non-interference rule. But he's also made a few noises that maybe he would go after adult use as opposed to medical. I think that though the fears about that have pretty much been sidetracked for the moment. I mean, we might well see something coming down the pike later, but I don't think it's a major factor in what is going on right now in the local governments and state government here in California.
Well, just last week, Jeff Sessions started talking about this issue again. The Department of Justice has been legally prohibited from going after medical marijuana, thanks to a passed budget amendment. They can't spend money on raids in states where it's legal to have medical marijuana. But that amendment expires in just 3 days, December 8th. So we have no idea if it's going to be extended. But even if it does remain in place, I'm wondering, does it preclude the DEA from going after recreational users, growers, dispensaries? Do you have a thought about what we can expect, Brooke?
So I think, you know, it does. If that does get extended, it does prevent them from using any federal resources from going after folks that are following their state law. And so if, you know, if that's extended, that'll be the case. If it's not, obviously there will be a lot of questions. You know, a lot of people have wondered, California is obviously going to be the biggest, already is the biggest, you know, cannabis market in the country, maybe even beyond that. And so people have wondered, does that make it untouchable? Is it, you know, the cat's out of the bag, it's too hard for federal government to try to rein it back in? Or does that put a target on California and, you know, make it more attractive for, you know, somebody like Jeff Sessions, who's obviously opposed to recreational marijuana, to go after it? And so far, you know, we saw a lot of concern, I think, from people right after the election, you know, that kind of had a bit of the wind taken out of their sail when Prop 64 passed because of what they saw happening at the federal level, wondering how it might affect, you know, things moving forward. And months passed and nothing changed. We haven't seen any type of crackdown happen. And so I think a lot of people have, you know, gotten more comfortable, more confident that things are going to be allowed to move forward. And then, as you said, just within the past couple of weeks, we've been hearing a little more out of Jeff Sessions, and then seeing the concern over this, you know, budget amendment being extended has maybe raised some of those concerns again for folks.
Well, certainly there are studies and surveys that show that people want to have access to medical marijuana, but is that setting up, given the extreme views in some ways of the administration, is it setting up a battle royal? Like you said, I can see the administration making California a test case on how to go after this. Dale, would it surprise you?
I'm not expecting it, at least in the short term, because the federal government hasn't done anything about Colorado or Nevada, which actually has an active, both of which have pretty active tourist markets going as well, or Oregon or Washington. Unless things somehow get out of hand in some big way, or somebody tempts fate, in the short term, I would be surprised if they moved on this. There's not a lot of political upside, and the polls show that even a majority of Republicans now support allowing the states to legalize marijuana. So I don't see any advantage to the administration to do this.
All right. Lots of callers want to weigh in and ask questions. The number, if you have a question, is 866-798-8255. Let's go to Lisa in San Francisco. Hi, Lisa.
Yes. Thank you so much for this program. You know, I noticed that there's a, you know, a lot of worry about whether or not the federal government's going to be going against the dispensaries and users. However, we're forgetting that there are technically in the United States millions of people, mostly people of color, who've been put in jail under these nefarious drug laws that make marijuana, specifically marijuana, into something similar to heroin. And what I think the counties should do that in the state level, especially if the state of California and other states have declared recreational marijuana as legal, they should first of all release the people who have been put in jail for those nefarious marijuana laws, and also provide funding from those taxes to help those people that have been released or are in jail to get back into society, even maybe even participating and helping them take part in being able to have a business, a marijuana business as well. Otherwise, it just seems very opportunistic that people of color end up paying the price for these laws, and then afterwards, when it's legal, they are the ones that least benefit from any of it. That's my opinion.
It's an interesting point. Thank you very much, Lisa. Dale Gehringer, you want to weigh in on that?
Well, first of all, I think it's one of the great things about Proposition 64 is that it did defelonize and decriminalize a whole bunch of crimes that used to be punishable as felonies, and it gives people with prior marijuana felonies the opportunity to reduce them to misdemeanors and or even dismiss them. And so we've had hundreds, I guess thousands now, of people with priors have been getting their records cleared. The other thing that Prop 64 does is it provides literally hundreds of millions of dollars for programs of various sorts, some for people with drug problems, some for communities that have been adversely affected by drug laws, and so forth. The funding from Prop 64 will be quite substantial once it starts taking effect with the taxes next year. But you can't do anything on the federal level, of course, at this moment, and there are still a bunch of people in federal prison and in other states for cannabis offenses.
Which is just bizarre to me, that literally people will be driving past penitentiaries, jails, lockups, where people are behind bars for possession, use, or distribution, and you can drive right past those jails to a legal dispensary. I mean, how do you square that circle? Any thoughts, Brooke?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely one of the main issues that I think drove a lot of people to support Prop 64, because there definitely is a social justice component to it. You know, Sean Parker, who's formerly of Facebook, was one of the biggest funders of the measure, and that was all along. He never did interviews, but, you know, through spokespeople, that's essentially what he said drove his involvement, was because, you know, people of color have been, you know, disproportionately impacted by the war on drugs. And so because this measure did provide funding for communities that have been, you know, disproportionately affected by that, and it did, you know, reduce those crimes to misdemeanors and in some cases got rid of them completely, I think that drove a lot of people to support it. And some cities are taking that into their own hands, too. We've seen L.A. and San Francisco and Oakland, there may be more out there, but that are trying to do equity programs as part of their regulations for cannabis businesses, where they would give priority to, you know, folks that had previously been involved in this industry and had, you know, something on the record because of that and are now trying to do it the right way and do a legal business. So there are some cities that are taking it, you know, a step further than Prop 64 and trying to, you know, undo some of those harms as much as possible.
And Brooke, you've written a great deal about the state regulations that will be required, but what is exactly becoming legal? Adults 21 and older can possess certain amounts of cannabis-based products. Individual can grow a certain number of plants in their homes. So what are the other tenets of the law at the state level?
Yeah, so those personal rights, like I said, kicked in November 9th of last year, the day after the election. So what starts January 1st is essentially the recreational side of the market, and sales is really, you know, what's going to affect most people. It's also going to be the first time that the state issues licenses to any type of cannabis business. So whether it's medical or recreational, and, you know, from growing to sales and everything in between, all of that will start on January 1st. So it's the first time, you know, that people will be able to go to a shop or, you know, support a grow or for their own business have one that has, you know, a state license to do so. Previously, they've been, you know, operating, if, you know, either obviously on the black market or some with their local permission, but they didn't have any, you know, official okay from the state. So that'll be a big change. And again, being able to January 1st, anyone who's 21 and over walk into a shop and purchase, you know, cannabis up to an ounce at a time with only showing their ID. So it'll be, you know, pretty similar to what, you know, the way that you walk into a liquor store or a bar and buy that product as well.
And individuals can grow up to 6 plants in their homes?
Correct. And yeah, and again, that kicked in the day after the election. So that nothing has changed there. I think it's just more people are becoming aware of it. Everyone has that, you know, January 1st deadline in their head, and so more people are kind of, I think, starting to talk about this. And also, when sales start, it'll be easier for folks to get their hands on seeds and things like that so that they can start those grows for themselves.
And there's some other regs, too, that are going to take place if they haven't already. Things like no dispensaries within 600 feet of schools. Edibles have to have up to only a certain amount of THC in them. Shops have to close by 10 o'clock. They must have 24-hour video surveillance. Any other notable regulations that I left out there?
There's a lot. There are 276 pages of rules that just came out within a couple weeks for all, you know, sides, medical, recreational. They originally, those were, there were two separate set of rules, and during the state budget bill in the summer, they got merged into one. And so it's one set of rules for both sides, and again, for all, you know, it regulates everything from, you know, how things can be transported and records that businesses have to keep, and you know, background checks that employees have to go through, again, until up until what the labels will look like on the, you know, the products that you buy. So a lot of new rules that folks are having to try to get, you know, their handle on within the next few weeks to try to be up and running. The state did give them a bit of a grace period on some of those rules, so businesses will have about 6 months from into the summer of next year where they can still sell products that aren't, that don't meet all of those standards yet if they label them that way, so that businesses aren't left with, you know, a big backlog of inventory that they just have to take as a loss. So there will be, for the first 6 months of 2018, you will still be able to buy some products that maybe haven't been lab tested or might have, you know, more than the allowed amount of THC in them and things like that. And then after starting July 1st, it'll all have to all be regulated.
Well, certainly a lot of questions have been generated. So for our callers, what are your hopes or concerns for California's legalizing pot in January? If you're part of the cannabis industry, from growing to sales to prescribing, what are your thoughts about the upcoming legalization? You can drop us an email at feedback@yourcallradio.org or give us a call at 866-798-8255. Dale Garinger, you have kept up with the differences in many cases between municipalities. So some cities have hit some pretty predictable snags in opening up the permit and licensing process. So figuring out the zoning and permitting regulations, I'm sure, can be pretty complicated, especially for big cities like L.A. and San Francisco. So can you talk about what might be slowing some cities down in getting their new programs up and running, Dale?
Well, San Francisco just tripped over its own feet and got bogged down in arguments about zoning, basically. Supervisors from various different districts of the city wanted different kinds of restrictions, and they were arguing about it, and they sort of passed the deadline for having a timely implementation of their ordinance, although they finalized it. It looks like San Francisco will not be ready on January 1st. It looks like the soonest they might be ready would be January 5th. Oakland got bogged down in a big dispute over equity permits and how to implement that, but it looks like Oakland is actually now back on track to be open on January 1st or as close to it as possible. A lot of cities and counties have just outright banned. In fact, more cities and counties have banned cannabis sales altogether than are permitting it. But it's the big cities that you have to look at. Those are the ones that are proceeding. San Jose is going to be proceeding. Santa Rosa is proceeding. However, they're not going to be allowing adult use sales. They're only proceeding, they're continuing with medical only, for the time being at least. Some other cities are going to be like that too. Santa Barbara is going to be like that. Now, as for Los Angeles, I sort of defer to Brooke to talk about that. That having always been a very difficult, Los Angeles always having been behind the ball on coming up with sensible regulations for cannabis in the first place.
Brooke, what's in place so far in L.A.?
So their situation is so complicated because they've really never given any type of permit for cannabis businesses, but some people estimate there may be as many as 1,000 dispensaries in the city at some point. You know, more than Starbucks is kind of the thing that people like to say. And so it's to try to rein that in. It's been so complicated because, you know, do you grandfather in the old shops? You know, what about ones that were trying to follow the rules and pay their taxes all along? but technically some of them were breaking the law, you know, along the way. And so trying to figure out how to do that in a way that's fair, and just because of the sheer size, obviously, of it. And because, as Dill said, they haven't, you know, set it up ahead of time to be ready for recreational. They hadn't gotten a handle on the medical side of things yet, and now they have to add recreational into it as well. And so it's been a scramble for them, I would say, probably more than any other city, for sure. They're actually tomorrow night at their meeting supposed to vote on a set of rules, and so we'll have to see how that goes. If I have a feeling it'll be similar to San Francisco, where they probably won't make the January 1st start, but sometime shortly after that, maybe more into like February. But we'll have to wait and see, you know, when that comes out, how that vote comes down, and how that all plays out.
Well,
they definitely do plan to allow the businesses. It's just a matter of when.
And their sheer size, I guess it shouldn't come as a tremendous surprise, that it's just challenging. But I understand that Santa Cruz and Humboldt seem ready to go. So, I mean, much smaller municipalities, counties, and obviously much smaller issues when you're trying to ramp up something like this. So we're going to take a break right now. What do you want to know about how your city or your county or your town is preparing for legalized recreational marijuana? We have Brooke Staggs, a general assignment reporter for the Southern California News Group, and Dale Garinger, he's State Director of California NORML, the National Association for the Reform of Marijuana Laws. We're going to talk about the real elephant in the room, because what's at stake here is trying to move from a state that's primarily unregulated, underground cannabis sales, to one where every gram is monitored from seed to sale. And that's a big switch. So how's that going to work? We hope you'll join us. We'll be right back. And we are back. I'm Renee Kemp, sitting in for Rose Aguilar today. And today we are talking pot. Starting January 1st, the state of California is about to join Colorado and Washington State in legalizing the recreational use of marijuana. What are some of the pitfalls that we might be able to avoid by looking at what happened in Washington and Colorado? What did they do right? What did they do wrong? We hope you'll give us a call, 866-798-8255, or your call at kalw.org. We're happy to get your comments and your questions. And we've got a lot of calls, not surprisingly. So let's go to our next call. Thanks for being here.
Hi.
Yep, go right ahead.
Oh, thank you. I wasn't sure if it was me. Roberta here. See, I have a question because I've been wondering, since it is recreationally okay to smoke anywhere in California because of the California law, does that mean that local PD and such cannot arrest people for smoking pot or having it with them?
Okay, Roberta, thank you. I think that's a very common concern. Dale, do you want to handle that?
Okay. There is no public consumption is allowed under Prop 64. So nothing in the streets or in the parks or anything else, or even places where you can smoke cigarettes, you cannot smoke or even consume, it says, theoretically, an edible in California, except on-site consumption is going to be permitted by local option at certain licensed premises. So there are going to be either cafes or dispensaries that have on-site consumption happening, and I know that that's going to happen at least in the city of Oakland, and I suspect San Francisco is going to do that too, and a number of other places, but it will only be by local option. Other than that, you can't smoke in public, but the pot—it's only a ticket. It's like a—it's $100 fine. It's not a criminal thing.
All right, thank you, Roberta. Let's go to Harry from San Francisco. Hi, Harry.
Yes, it seems to be one of the major reasons for "quote unquote" legalizing marijuana is that a lot of people were being thrown in jail, and even in Golden Gate Park, the police would send out undercover cops to try to bust people selling marijuana. Now, how is that going to change? Because if it's subject to a sales tax, therefore anyone not selling it and charging sales tax is illegal. So is that going to be enforced? Isn't this going to create a lot more harassment for people outside the system. As you pointed out, there are places in California where they don't even actually have any clinics. So how is that going to proceed? Thank you.
Brooke Staggs, can you weigh in on that for us?
Sorry, I had a little hard time understanding. It was a little fuzzy connection on my end with that. Was it a concern about more enforcement as a sales tax and things kick in?
And what's going to happen with weed as people still try to sell illegally?
Gotcha. And there definitely still are penalties, you know, for that if people are operating outside of the legal system, but almost all of them were reduced under Prop 64. So, you know, it's the conditions of it, how much, you know, was involved and things like that, but, you know, there still are definitely penalties in place for the sellers of that. And, you know, a lot of, there is tax money that will come from Prop 64 that will go toward law enforcement, you know, at the state level, and then local communities can, if they allow businesses in their boundaries, they can apply for grant money that can go toward public safety enforcement as well. So there's an expectation that, you know, there will be a step up of enforcement in trying to crack down on that black market to try to move people, you know, into the legal market and give it a chance at success. Because obviously if they let the black market continue, you know, unhinged, then the legal shops that are facing all these taxes and, you know, costs for compliance wouldn't have a chance at being successful.
And Dale, with the issue of taxation, right now all cannabis has to go through licensed distributors with taxes collected. But you've said that taxes at the outset might turn out to be prohibitively high, something like 25% in state taxes plus local taxes added on top of that. But there's some lessons to be learned about being careful about overtaxing. Can you talk about what we've learned from Washington State on that?
Well, that's correct. I happen to think that the taxes, as they have been established, which do amount to an additional 25% above what is currently being charged, at least at the medical dispensaries, are excessively high, especially because a lot of local governments have decided to throw in additional taxes on top of that, as high as 10 or 15%. So you're approaching like 40% in additional new taxes. And of course, that raises the problem of making the cost of the legal cannabis prohibitively high and inviting people to go to the illegal market. Now, that was in Washington State, they started out with comparably very high taxes, which they subsequently had to adjust. The taxes there are still rather high, although I don't think they're as high as they're going to be in California with our local taxes added in. But it took, a year and a half or more for the legal market to really phase in Washington. So, you know, we'll see how long it takes here to drive the illegal dealers out of business, because it means the price of the legal cannabis has got to go down to a place where it can compete with the illegal market. That's going to take a while before the industry is settled down and can do that. So we're going to have a black market for some time to come, I predict.
I thought it was an interesting point that you made. You mentioned that in some of your writings, when alcohol was first prohibited and then repealed, they first repealed it and put a tax on it, but it was only 5%, very, very low. And they chose that low tax rate because if it was higher, there would be an incentive for bootlegging. So it's pretty much exactly the same thing here, right?
Exactly, yes.
And you said Colorado was pretty much where Washington kind of overreached and overtaxed. You feel like Colorado is closer to getting it right? What are they doing right?
I think the Colorado system's working pretty well. The taxes are somewhat lower than they are in California. And the other thing about Colorado is it never had a large pre-existing industry growers and sellers there. Colorado really started by establishing a regulated market, and the first people to really grow in a large scale in Colorado were doing so under regulation. Here in California, we have tens of thousands of growers who have been growing for over a generation now, and we're trying to get them involved in the legal regulated market. But if the costs of doing so are too high, a lot of those people are going to continue doing what they have been all along.
And Brooke Stacks, what is going to be the difference between a license to cultivate, a license to dispense, a license to possess, to use? These are all very, very different parts of the new law, right? And it depends on where you are in the state. It seems like a real patchwork quilt. So what's the difference between these licenses?
So they're, you know, the rules for all of them are established at the state level, and different state agencies oversee different ones. So the Cannabis Bureau oversees sales and testing and things like that, and Department of Agriculture oversees growing and health manufacturing. So they all have, you know, their own set of rules, their own set of regulations, and some carry over for all. They all have to be, you know, have sales tracked from seed to sale, they say. So the plant will be, you know, tracked all the way through the system to try to make sure that it's not diverted into that black market. But then once you get past those state-level rules, you know, even if you're meeting all of those requirements, you still have to have that local permission in order to open. And so that's going to be, you know, the most challenging thing for a lot of businesses to apply, even for these temporary permits that the state will be issuing come January 1st. They have to show that they have permission from their local government to operate the specific type of business that, you know, they're planning to open. So if they want to be, you know, a recreational shop, their city has to have already okayed that and, you know, have its own set of regulations in place. And so that's why we're seeing a lot of these cities scramble to get their policies. You know, if they want to be able to have their businesses part of that market as it kicks off January 1st, they're trying to get those policies in place. But they, and then the locals, you know, can apply their own set of taxes, their own set of regulations. Obviously, tax would have to go on the ballot, but so we see a wide range, you know, even within that, of what they can look like. Some, you know, cities are saying you can only have one shop, just putting a hard number on it, you know, that's arbitrary. Some are doing the businessing by zoning, so only allowing them in, you know, certain industrial zones and things like that. Some are letting people, you know, do like a merit-based application system. Some cities are doing a lottery. So it really is just, like you said, a complete patchwork. You really don't know. It's hard for people to know, you know, from city to city what the rules are, because there are huge differences between one and the other.
Yeah, you said that Palm Springs seems to be on the forefront of just pushing solid legalization, which is kind of shocking because Palm Springs is pretty conservative, but they seem to be open and, well, ready to be open and ready for business come January 1st. Dale or Brooke, where do you see some promising smooth transitions happening? Brooke or Dale?
I would say, yeah, for Southern California, you know, San Diego is the biggest city by far that seems to be on track to start January 1st sales. And they have, you know, had their regulated market for medical in place for a while. And so, you know, most of those cases, it's essentially going to be allowing their existing medical shops to just, you know, essentially flip a switch and start selling recreational. So they're definitely, you know, out there. And then other than that, it's a lot of the smaller cities. So like you said, Palm Springs, well-known, but still a smaller city, but they, you know, have everything in place. They've already had a tax measure on the ballot that just got passed, and so they're, you know, ready to have that in place come January 1st.
Berkeley and Oakland are in a similar situation. They're all ready to go. I think San Jose will be too, and San Francisco only a few days later for the sales. But I think Humboldt County deserves mention for being ready to deal with the cultivation issue, because they have already started their own track and trace program for the growing of marijuana on the county level. So the growers up there have already started to adjust to this new, much different, highly regulated cultivation system that the state's going to require, and I think they're going to be out of the gate first as far as cultivation is concerned.
We're talking to Dale Gehringer. He's the state director of California Normal, the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws, and the author of Marijuana Medical Handbook, And we're talking to Brooks Staggs, General Assignment Reporter for the Southern California News Group based at the Orange County Register and lead writer for the Californian, a news website covering cannabis in California. So what do you want to know about how your city or your county is preparing for legalized recreational marijuana come January 1st? Give us a call, 866-798-8255, or drop us a line at yourcall@kalw.org. You know, Dale, I'm wondering if it might not be a real public service because there seems to be such a patchwork of ordinances around this thing coming as of January 1st. My guess is that one of the biggest new markets will be for recreational pot will be tourists. Any ideas about just having sort of a yellow pages or some kind of a book to let people know, depending on where you're going in the state, this is what you can expect?
Oh, I'm sure that places will be advertising quickly and rapidly. The tourist market in California is huge. We have more tourists per year than we have residents. And I think that's where a lot of the money and tax money is going to be coming from as we go forward. There are already resources for finding some of these places. There are websites where you can find them out. I expect there will be more of them as we move forward.
Another issue we haven't talked about quite yet is supply. According to David Downs of the San Francisco Chronicle, he reported on $1 billion cannabis crop loss from the North Bay fires earlier in the year, back in October. And Dale, you've said that California grows far more marijuana than it needs. So even after the fires and the drought have caused the California crops to suffer, you're saying there will be no shortage of supply here?
Right. This is the elephant in the room. By the state's own estimates, and I think it's like most experts pretty much agree on this, California grows maybe on the order of 12 million pounds of marijuana, of which we only consume maybe 2 million or 2.5. The rest of it goes out of state. This has been going on for a long, long time. So we have this enormous out-of-state market that's going to persist as long as there is prohibition in, you know, New York and Illinois and the rest of the United States. Though it's not legal for any of the licensed producers to grow for that out-of-state market, but since it is much larger, in fact, than the in-state market, we're going to continue having to deal with it. And I am concerned that at some point the federal government might decide to come in, as it has in the past, and say, hey, there's too much pot being grown out in the national forests and so forth, California, and it's getting to Utah and Alabama, and we need to crack down on it. So if anything invites a federal crackdown, I think it could be that out-of-state market, which is driven by national prohibition.
All right, let's take another call. Hi, John. Thanks for calling. John in Antioch. Thanks for being with us. Hi, John. Can you hear us?
Yeah, how you doing?
Good. Go right ahead.
All right. So I was curious about people who work for jobs that have, you know, federal screening tests, federal drug tests in a state. How is that used for someone in that situation? For example, you know, if it's alcohol, you can have alcohol tested within a matter of a couple different marijuana days in the system for 30 days. You get tested and flush you. How do they prove that, in fact, you didn't open that day and you've been driving under the influence?
Okay, John, thank you. Brooke, maybe you can attack that one. What if companies are still drug testing, but the weed is legal?
Sure, yeah. Prop 64 was really clear about that fact, that businesses can still, you know, test for cannabis and choose to hire or fire based on those results. So really, you know, on that level, nothing has changed. But we have definitely heard, you know, examples of companies that have said since the measure passed they're no longer going to include, you know, marijuana in the panel of things that they test for. And part of that is, as we've heard, you know, particularly some stories out of like the Silicon Valley where they realize they're really going to limit their job pool if they do that. Mm. And a lot of the problem is because, as the caller said, you know, cannabis stays in for so long, especially if, you know, if you're a medical user, a heavy user, you know, it can be in your system for a long time and clearly long past the time that you're actually impaired by the substance. And this is the same problem that we have with tests for driving under the influence of marijuana. It's not the same as alcohol, you know, where you can really clearly tell based on, you know, blood levels and things if they were impaired at the time versus, again, if they're just a long-time user that, you know, it's stored in your fat cells and things like that. It's just not processed by our bodies the same way. And so there is money out of Prop 64 that's going toward, you know, testing for this. The state actually contracted with UC San Diego. They're about halfway through a three-year test, working on, you know, trying to develop better tests for driving. But again, the driving and the employment thing, I think, are very much linked. If we can come up with a good test, you know, that could tell impairment versus just having it in your system long after the fact, I think that would be good for, you know, both of those concerns.
Let's
the California normal that this employment rights is an important issue for us, and we're trying to get some legislation at least to protect the right of medical cannabis users to use it. Because the current situation is that you can be an opiate, a prescription opiate user, and it's fine if you flunk your drug test, you have a medical excuse, but it's not the same with marijuana. So we're really encouraging opiates and other prescription drugs at the expense of medical marijuana. So we are looking to try to get some legislation on this in Sacramento. There was a bill to do that some years ago, but Governor Schwarzenegger vetoed it. But nothing can be done about the federal regulations until federal law is changed.
All right, let's take another call. Hi, Bob. You're in Richmond. Thanks for calling.
Thank you very much. I'm an attorney, and I'm interested in helping people who want to get certified for distribution stores. But my concern is that the bar has a prohibition against providing information for any client that would break, violate any laws. And while you're inconsistent with California laws, you'll be advising clients to break federal laws by helping them set up, you know, get certified and any, and, you know, really literally any advice almost that you give to people. So I wondered if anybody knew how they were going to get around attorneys, you know, basically violating federal law by representing California clients.
Dale?
Well, actually, there's already many attorneys advising clients on how to get involved in the medical, in the cannabis business in California. And there was actually a bill this year in the legislature by, I think, Assemblyman Chu that fixed some of the problems in California's legal ethics code that could have been read to prohibit involvement by attorneys in the cannabis industry. So there's no legal problems or ethical problems under California law anymore in that regard. I haven't heard anybody raise concerns about the federal conflict.
Well, there are other issues surrounding banking, federal banking laws, and depositing money that is the result of having made these marijuana sales, and as a result, these dispensaries handling huge sums of money. And some municipalities are looking at starting their own financial institutions to kind of get around that issue. Brooke, what have you heard about progress along those lines?
Yeah, the state has a banking work group under the treasurer that's been, you know, studying this issue for some time, and they just came out with some recommendations, including, you know, the state maybe contracting with armored truck services to take the cash that a lot of these businesses have, you know, take them to the tax agencies and process them and things like that, because they're just handling so much cash. It's obviously inviting, you know, criminal activity. So they're looking at that, and they are, you know, recommending that the state do a full study on creating a public bank. There's a lot of question about whether that's practical and, you know, if that would work, but I think San Francisco, LA has talked about it, but it seems like San Francisco has been the most active at really looking at doing that to serve its cannabis businesses and also some other, you know, underrepresented customers that may have a hard time getting traditional banking. But it's certainly an issue, you know, come January 1st, again, it's going to be a multi-billion dollar market. That's, you know, tax money and payments that are coming through almost all in cash. And so it's risky for the businesses and the customers. And it's harder, obviously, to track if they are staying within the regulated market, if it's all, you know, an all cash business. So there's a lot of reasons that even if you don't support cannabis, that, you know, it makes sense to give them banking options so that you can be able to track it, you know, in a better way. And there are a lot of other areas that, because cannabis is still federally illegal, that even in states, you know, where it's legal, the banking issue is one of them, but there are still problems with people. We talked about the employment issue, you know, people getting access. If they have federally subsidized housing, they can lose it if they are found to be a cannabis consumer. They've had trouble getting insurance, so that's what caused, you know, so much of the problem for the cultivators in Northern California during the fire. Military service, gun ownership, there's a, you know, there's a long list of things that people still have trouble with, even if they're following their state rules because of the federal illegality still being there.
Brooke Staggs, a cannabis reporter for the Southern California News Group and a lead writer for The Californian, I'm going to let that be your last word, but Dale Gehringer, State Director of California Normal, with about 30 seconds left, do you have any final thoughts?
No, I don't, other than everybody should be aware that some of the most important action is with their local governments. And if you're not satisfied with access to cannabis in your city or your county, you should work with your city and county, because that's where most of the obstacles to adult use access exist.
All right. Dale Gehringer, thank you so much. And Brooke Staggs, appreciate you joining us. Thanks to the listeners and for the phone calls and email. Sorry we couldn't get to all of you. We can listen to past shows at yourcallradio.org. Ali Budner produced today's show. Thanks for joining us. I'm Renee Kemp, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.